Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, August 3rd, 2002. Today's session is titled Global Climate Change, Truth and Consequences, A Bright Future, How Can We Begin? Presented by Philip Mote. The number is MOP 2002-05. Let's listen in.
This is a sort of a farewell going on there, so I'm assuming that once the bus leaves, the drums will stop. In case you are looking for the vision seminar that's next door, this is Global Climate Change. I titled this series Global Climate Change, Truth and Consequences, and I want to wrap up the series. If you haven't seen the earlier talks, that's okay, because this is really the most hopeful one. First, let me introduce my multimedia assistants here, Nat Mote and my son, and Isaac, his friend. Appreciated Nat's help especially, and Isaac has joined in for the last two presentations. If you came to the earlier talks, you heard some really depressing stories about how climate change is to some extent inevitable, and that it will cause some damage, much of which we can't imagine, let alone predict. But the message today is that we can do something about climate change, and we can, at the same time, improve the quality of life right now. So, you'll notice I've changed my background. I've been using a green background all week, and just to emphasize that this is a different talk, I've changed the background, and I also have a visual aid to underscore that this is an optimistic talk. So just a moment. Somebody told me that they thought the Holden hilarity was a little low this week. So, if you can take me seriously wearing this, fine. I do know what I'm talking about. So here's where we've been. Monday we talked about the science of global climate change and what the evidence says that in fact we have seen some warming and that humans are most likely responsible. Second, we talked about the impacts of climate change, all the sad stories about what's going to happen to ecosystems and poor countries. Then we did sort of a Bible study and looked at the Bible passages relating to care for the environment and underscoring that the earth is entrusted to us for the provision of food and, we can read into it, medicine for future generations. And then yesterday I talked about how despite the best efforts of many nations in the world over the last 15 years of negotiations, there really is no international framework for moving forward on this. But so I want to finish off today with this message of hope. I showed this yesterday. These are the main gases that are contributing to climate change, with carbon dioxide being responsible for most, methane about half as much, chlorofluorocarbons about half as much again, and then ozone, which we produce through urban pollution, and nitrous oxide. So as we think about solving climate change, we want to do not only carbon dioxide, but also look at these others. Yes?
Did we establish that if you burn the methane, that is one way of getting rid of it? Or does that still...
Right. If you have a choice of emitting a methane molecule or a carbon dioxide molecule, it's better to emit a carbon dioxide molecule. So it's better to flare methane coming out of landfills or whatever than to simply let it escape. But it's better still to capture it and burn it and get energy from it. And that's what's happening, and I'll talk about that a little bit. So, some near-term solutions. This was a nice paper that came out last December in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It was somewhat misinterpreted in the media. Jim Hansen argued that because methane has a very short lifetime, and because it's half as important as CO2, that we can reduce our input of methane and see a fairly immediate effect, whereas carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere longer, and so if we continue emitting, or if we cut carbon dioxide, it takes longer to see the effect. So methane is a really good target for some early action on climate change. And he points to farms, not just ruminants, cows, and so on, which I've mentioned before, and landfills, but there are other aspects of farming that produce methane. Landfills and mining, as I said. So these are all economically beneficial things to do that also rapidly will make a difference to climate change. Then, of course, air pollution, which I talked about yesterday. Air pollution, a lot of what makes air pollution also makes greenhouse gases, and it also makes people sick and ruins the views if you live in places like Southern California that have views to look at. And Seattle, I should add. Seattle has bad air pollution problems and beautiful views. Third, make sure the chlorofluorocarbon problem stays solved. We've pretty well phased out production, but there is a growing risk of pirating, essentially, in third world countries where they have more lax laws and CFCs could be manufactured. And then finally, and this was where the media kind of got it wrong, the media, especially the more conservative papers, sort of said, oh, well, he's predicting not much change in climate. Well, if you actually read the paper, he's saying, if we do all these things now and do our best on CO2, then there won't be much change in climate, just a couple degrees Celsius in the next 100 years. But he really does emphasize that we have to tackle CO2 eventually. It's just that these other things are maybe more attractive near-term solutions. I showed this yesterday, and it's going to guide much of my presentation today. This is the one equation for the last half of the week, essentially saying that the buildup of carbon in the atmosphere, the rate of change of carbon, is equal to a term that's the product of population, economic wealth, the amount of energy taken to produce wealth, and then the amount of carbon that you use in producing the energy. And then you can subtract the sinks, or the things that we can do that would actually take carbon out of the atmosphere. So I think I've got a little animation here. So first we'll talk about increased energy efficiency and ways that we can do that. Then renewables, and then sinks. These three are more tractable problems than if we were to set up, say, trying to reduce population growth, never mind the fact that it is a politically very charged issue, the turnover time of the population means that if you make a small reduction, say, in the fertility rate per woman, it takes decades for that to show up as a noticeable change in population. So, and likewise, nobody in their right mind is going to go around saying we need to solve the climate change problem by having more recessions. So, we're going to leave those two out of it. Those really are not things that are, you know, suitable policy goals for climate change. So, we'll talk about these three in that order. So, energy efficiency, the IPCC, which I mentioned on Monday, this huge group of scientists and others who write these reports every 5 years about climate change, have identified the sort of economic net benefits of doing different things about climate change. So they said buildings, Isaac, could you fiddle with the focus a little bit there, see if we can improve this? I thought I had it, but other way. That's better. Good. Thanks. If you invest in efficiency of buildings, even existing buildings, that pays dividends over the life of the building. Easily will pay you back many times over. Especially if you do that up front. If you spend an extra 20% on a building to make it more energy efficient, you know, by positioning windows the right way, by insulating better, by thinking about how the space is constructed, there are a lot of things that can be done that will save that amount of money over the life of the building. Industry, as I said, much of the efficiency gains have been in industry, and most of the changes they make are also a net economic benefit. Home appliances, likewise. The IPCC actually didn't mention this, but other places I've seen. A good example of how the federal government can do something positive for a problem like this without really costing anybody much is refrigerators. Somebody figured out that although you could buy a more energy efficient refrigerator for about $50 more, the people who buy refrigerators are 70, something like 70% non-bill payers, if you will. They're either contractors who are building lots of houses or apartments. They want to get the job done as cheaply as possible, so they'll just stick an appliance in there. Or they are landlords who are buying the appliance, and then somebody else is paying the bills. So the government said, let's simply, because of this structure, let's simply mandate that all new refrigerators have to be that $50 more fuel efficient or energy efficient refrigerator. And this is the Energy Star program. This is part of the Energy Star program, which you may have heard of. They now label other appliances. Refrigerators are, as far as I know, oh, and air conditioners now, are the only ones that are mandated to have better energy efficiency. So look for the Energy Star label if you're buying home appliances, because that means it's more energy efficient and it will pay for itself over the life of the appliance. Now with transportation, you can make gains, but the typical lifetime of a vehicle is shorter than for appliances and buildings. So although you can invest in energy efficiency for your vehicles, you have to be driving a whole lot for that to pay off. But they said this works out to less than $25 per ton of carbon, which if you think about it in terms of what it would add to the cost of a gallon of gas, it's only, I think, about 5 cents. So it's really not a big cost to go more fuel efficient. So an example of the transportation is the Honda Insight. This vehicle with the optional manual transmission gets up to 80 miles to the gallon. And it's a little two-seater, aluminum frame, very low drag coefficient because of its shape. And what makes it special is this hybrid gas-electric engine. And what's neat about that is it's not simply that you've got an electric motor in your car, but that your energy of motion is converted back into energy in the battery. In a normal car, when you hit the brakes, or when we get on the bus and go down the hill and hit the brakes on the bus, that energy simply goes to heating up the brake shoes and brake pads. It becomes heat, it's dissipated into the atmosphere, and it's lost. With the hybrid vehicles, the Insight, the Civic hybrid version, and Toyota Prius, that energy is used to run the electric motor in reverse and recharge the battery. This allows these cars to achieve much higher fuel efficiency, not just in terms of miles per gallon, but the energy in the gas is moving the same amount of mass farther because it's used more efficiently. So there is talk that Ford will bring out a hybrid vehicle next year, possibly the Ford Escape, which is its smallest SUV. But so far, the Japanese are definitely winning this game. These have been very popular cars. They're selling far faster than Honda and Toyota expected. All right, so the second component is switching to renewables. Wind energy, biomass, where you grow crops and then either convert it into ethanol for use in vehicles or biodiesel, or you can use it to generate electricity. This is very popular in the grain states in the middle of the country. And senators and congresspeople from Iowa have introduced lots of bills to make this move along. Solar energy, hydropower, which we have a lot of here in the Northwest, it's the cornerstone of our fossil-free, nearly fossil-free electricity, which allows utilities around here to be sort of smug about how they're not emitting as much CO2 as others. Not a whole lot of potential for expansion of new hydropower plants, but It's possible to upgrade existing ones to generate more electricity without doing any further environmental damage. Nuclear plants, somewhat controversial because of the pesky problem of the waste, which tends to stay around for thousands of years, but it's a fossil-free source, so it has to be mentioned here. And then for transportation, of course, fuel cells. The Clinton administration created what's called the Partnership for the Next Generation of Vehicles, PNGV, and Al Gore was part of that. And it included representatives from lots of auto manufacturers, and their goal was to build cars that would get 50 to 80 miles to the gallon. Well, Bush came along and said, we need to look beyond that, and he really pushed, he sort of abandoned the PNGV and really said, within 10 years, we need to have fuel cell technology. A fuel cell is sort of like a battery. You put in hydrogen, and you get an electrical current. The difference with the battery is you just keep pouring in hydrogen the way you put gas in your tank, and you keep getting electricity that can move a car or a bus. And these are used in a sort of experimental way in buses in six third world countries. Then there's other geothermal wave tidal, other possibilities. Here's a picture of some typical wind turbines. There are entire wind farms like this, many of them in California, but they're sprouting up here in eastern Washington, eastern Oregon. You tend to want to have a bunch of them to collect the generation, because each one tends not to generate anywhere near as much as a giant coal-fired power plant, which might make 1,000 megawatts. The largest wind turbines in common use now make 1 megawatt each, which is a lot of power. That's enough to heat 1,000 homes. So you collect them in these big farms, and then you can ship the power away. The problem with wind, of course, is when the wind's not blowing, you don't have any electrical power. And utilities like to be able to match the load their customers are asking for. And it doesn't work to say, well, we'll sell you power when the wind's blowing. So although utilities are increasingly turning to these as part of their renewable portfolio, which some states actually have a requirement for, but unfortunately President Bush just knocked down the idea as a national standard, they don't want to have wind be their only source, or indeed very much. So wind is nice, but it's got its problems. Let's see where wind is most feasible. This map shows the wind resource potential. The deep blues are excellent, the light blues are good, green is fair, and then yellow is marginal, and white is don't even bother. And I mentioned that many of the first wind farms went up in California. I grew up right here in Vacaville, and there were wind farms in the East Bay in what is listed here as a marginal area. And somehow they made a go of it despite that. Likewise, there are some in Southern California. Some of them are in these mountainous areas that are deep blue, where there's excellent potential. But a lot of them are out in the desert here, where again it's only marginal. So now with a better understanding, a lot of those were developed 30 years ago. Now with better understanding, people are starting to look at these deep blue areas in Wyoming, Montana, North Dakota. The problem is that the load is far away from those places. And so then you have a lot of transmission loss. So one thought is to use, to put wind farms in these fairly uninhabited, very windy places and generate hydrogen and then use those for fuel cells. Of course, we'll also want to have a lot of this on the grid. So there's a good possibility for wind. Let's do a, okay, yeah, this comes next. This is a graph by year here of the amount of energy taken from these different sources up to the year 2000, and then one scenario for how it might go in the next 65 years. The reds are traditional biomass, means people going out into the forest, cutting down trees, and burning it in their fireplaces. And before coal came on the scene, of course, that was the main source of energy for heating and cooking and so on. Coal, of course, started in the 19th century, and by 1900, it had overtaken wood and it remained the dominant source of energy until about the 1940s when oil took over. Oil is in green, natural gas is in this, I don't know what color you'd call that.
You're talking about electrical generation?
This is total energy. Oh, so it's not just electricity, it's also for transportation.
This is worldwide.
This is worldwide. Now, in this scenario, the worldwide demand for energy is expected to triple in the next 30 years or so, 30 to 40 years. That is a huge growth in demand. And under this scenario, which is put out by Shell International, which no longer calls itself Shell Oil because they want to be part of this new future, the use of fossil fuels, which is these three things combined, peaks in about 2025 and then begins declining. The additional growth then is made up largely of growth in wind energy, which right now is just less than 1% of global energy. Biomass, this is new biomass, like what I described with growing corn to make ethanol and so on. Solar, and then geothermal, and what they call surprise. This is something we haven't thought of yet. And now you see that even with this huge growth in all these things that are now just sort of boutique sources, fossil fuels are still 40% of the total mix by 2060. And although in this scenario, of course, we would have capped our emissions of greenhouse gases because the emissions go roughly as the amount burned, you're still on a very slow decline toward the very low emissions that we need to stabilize. So this is optimistic in one sense in assuming that these boutique sources can shoulder that much of the load, but it's also not going far enough in the sense of stabilizing the climate at a reasonable value.
Question?
Yes.
When you talk about fuel cells, they're in there somewhere because you had to use
They're not. Somebody unplug the projector.
Somebody.
Okay. Yeah, they're not in there because the energy, hydrogen is sort of a temporary way of storing the energy. The only way to strip hydrogen out of, say, water molecules is using electricity. Okay. So all you're doing is moving the energy generation from the vehicle where we used to burn things back to wherever your hydrogen plant is.
Another question, the units on that were exajoules.
Exajoules, yeah, that's...
What are those? 10 to the...
I think it's 10 to the 18th joules, which probably doesn't help at all. I can tell you, I might be able to work it out in terawatts. I think it's something like, the current demand is something like 400 terawatts, but that probably doesn't mean much either. It's a huge amount. Thank you. The point here is really how fast energy demand is expected to grow and has grown since the 1950s. You see there really was a change in the slope of this line. Very slow growth to the 1950s, and then we had sort of a new energy revolution, and most of that was fueled by coal and oil. Yes?
Now, I'm looking out to the 2060 line there,
yeah,
which is roughly comparable, it looks like, the amount of energy contributed by oil currently, maybe a little more. Is there known technology to exploit that?
Let's see, you mean if we compare...
If I look at the green bar there,
yeah,
and I look at its widest, it's
the
roughly equivalent, I'm guessing, to the solar 2060, right?
You mean the amount of solar is roughly
equal to
roughly
the
equal
of oil
to
today.
Today.
So my amount of oil today.
So my question is there known technology to exploit that?
Let's go to the next slide because
there's a question.
Oh, yes.
So that surprise right there on the right top, the graph there.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, that they're just being hopeful. Yeah, the surprise is something we haven't thought of yet. It's, they don't list in here wave energy, which is, there are only a handful of plants right now that exploit wave energy. But yeah, this is just really, let's hope that something else comes along. And they aren't giving it a very big role.
What do you mean wave energy?
Oh, they're in either tides or the regular up and down motion of water has a lot of energy in it. And so you can build a sort of shallow dam across an inlet and then have some turbines in there. And when the tide goes out or comes in, it runs the turbines. There are also ways to capture the up and down motion of waves similarly. But at present, I think there's one plant operating in France, one in the Bay of Fundy in eastern Canada, and they're talking about doing one somewhere near Vancouver Island.
Just one more question on the source here. I expect this is more than just Shell's expectations, or I mean, is there more sources?
Not that I know of. I think this is Shell's own analysis. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So
it isn't necessarily.
And you know, if the Western Fuels Association, which represents coal manufacturers, were to do this, I'm sure it would look very different. You know, it would be, it probably the top part of the curve would be the same, but it would, you know, you'd see this huge growth in coal, and all the rest would remain very small.
It surprises me the amount of traditional biomass. Is that burning in third world countries?
Yeah.
Charcoal
and stuff? Yeah. And in this scenario, this levels off.
Right.
As more and more of them have access to modern technology. One thing to note about this, people often ask, well, when will the fossil fuels run out? Natural gas it doesn't have a lot of time left, and I'm actually surprised to see it playing such a big role by 2060, because my understanding is that if we burn it at this rate, it'll be pretty well gone by about 2075. Oil, as I think I said before, new discoveries of oil are running about 6 billion barrels of oil a day, and consumption, or is that per year? I think that's per year globally. Consumption is 28 billion barrels per year. So we're already, you know, rapidly eating into the backlog of discovered oil, and it's expected that production will peak in about 2015 or so. And you can see that oil peaks earlier. It peaks about 2015, and then this green bar starts to shrink. That's going to happen with or without climate policy. As we get to the peak in production, the price will go up rapidly. If we burn all the coal in the ground, it would take us about 500 years, and the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere would reach 2,000 parts per million, or about 7 times the pre-industrial value. And at that level, we would be probably seeing climate changes on the order of 10 to 20 degrees Celsius of a global warming. So at some point, even if we put this off for another 50 years, at some point we will stop burning coal before it runs out, simply for that reason. Yeah.
Don't you get CO2 when you burn biomass also?
Yeah, the difference is that with biomass, and this is the same reason that we don't worry about people breathing. When you breathe, you are breathing out, say you had cornflakes, you're breathing out carbon that came out of the atmosphere in Iowa last summer, and you're just putting it back in. When you burn biomass, you're just putting carbon back into the atmosphere that came out whenever that plant grew. Now, it's a good idea to store those old growth trees, you know, store the carbon in old growth trees, and I'll come to that sequestration bit in a minute. But it's okay to use biomass in that way because we're not getting carbon out of the ground, and that's the main thing. Okay, let's move ahead and look at the prices for these things. This, again, the numbers look at who put this out and think there might be a little bit of spin going on. Natural gas, and it is difficult actually to boil it down this much because these different sources, you have to consider, for example, how close you are to your load, what type of plant you build, and so on. So it's not a matter of, you know, we've got X plant, would we be better off running natural gas or coal or, you know, solar? It doesn't work that way. So these calculations are really fudgy numbers, but natural gas is the cheapest fuel currently at about 4 cents per kilowatt hour. But wind, with the new production tax credit, or I shouldn't say new, the recently renewed production tax credit, comes in right down there, and it's competitive with coal. This is why you see wind farms sprouting up all over the place, because it now makes economic sense, even without considering the environmental damage of coal. Hydropower, now this is a really difficult calculation to do, because once you build the plant, it's the fuel is free. So it's all in how you consider the construction costs and what lifetime you expect. But this is now thought, new hydro is thought to be very expensive because of the environmental damages and the sorts of things you have to do to mitigate that. Biomass turns out really not to be cost competitive. So when these senators from Iowa push biomass as a solution, you have to really skew the market to get that to happen. And then nuclear, of course, is very expensive. The safety issues require just extremely expensive plants. The fuel is fairly expensive as well. And then, as I've said, there's the pesky problem of how do you store it. So the market alone is favoring gas and wind, but it's going to take more than this sort of very gradual market shift to unseat King Coal. Yes?
Does those disadvantages from nuclear power, isn't there some offsetting benefit? I mean, notwithstanding all those problems.
Yeah, I should have said solar is about 12 cents per kilowatt, so it's up here also with nuclear. And even those more expensive sources are going to have to be part of the mix, because if you added the true cost of coal, the environmental cost to the cost of coal, this would go up. The price would roughly double, and it would be comparable to nuclear. And this already, in effect, includes the environmental externalities, because people have insisted on those things being included, on those extreme safety precautions and the very expensive storage options and so on. So whereas coal is very dirty. I mean, we cleaned up a lot of plants under the Clean Air Act, but there are some that were grandfathered. So there are advantages over coal, even though it's more expensive. Yeah.
The nuclear estimate there, is that for the traditional type of reactor?
I can tell you if that's a breeding reactor or what. Judy?
Is there any way besides, I mean, I don't want to hear the, obviously the coal industry view of it, is there any way to burn coal efficiently and cleanly?
In the Bush-Cheney energy plan, there was a big push for so-called clean coal. And clean simply means it has a lower sulfur content. And of course, sulfur causes acid rain, so that's bad. But if you have a scrubber on a plant, you're getting a lower energy yield. So it actually generates more CO2 per BTU of energy that you get out. Clean coal requires less scrubbing, so you get a little bit more energy out, but it's still, I mean,
there's clean, just no way.
Yeah, clean coal is like, you know, diet donuts or something. Okay, let's
you mentioned that environmental costs are built into those things. Do you know of any kinds of studies that have any kind of, you know, appreciation and objectivity that can be?
The state of Minnesota in, I think, 1997, how many of you are from Minnesota? Wow, okay. Well, maybe some of you can set me straight on this, but my understanding is that in 1997, the state of Minnesota instituted I'm not sure quite what to call it, but it's a surcharge on coal. That reflects the damage that carbon dioxide does. And I think they came up with a figure of $25 per ton of CO2. And they use that not in not in actually pricing electricity, but in making decisions about which energy source to use. And can anybody fix that explanation?
I think I was going to ask the question before, what's the difference in energy or CO2 producing efficiency or inefficiency, say, between natural gas and coal? I mean, if you want to get a kilowatt hour natural gas versus coal.
Yeah, I think it's on the order of three or four times.
So you can try to use that factor in pricing coal or comparing the true price.
Yeah,
in a sense.
Yeah, and gas is already competitive with coal without that.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. So there's a huge push toward combined heat and electricity plants using gas. This is a sort of new wave in fossil fuels, and it's a good transition away from coal.
That almost sounds like a convenience surcharge for the politicians to be able to just drop money into a lump fund to be able to use for something else.
I don't know if there's any money actually changing hands. No. With that, I think it might just be when you do a cost-benefit analysis, this is how you have to price the coal.
My concern is that whether out of the scientific community, economic community, there was a real push to come up with a formula, if you will, that could be acceptable to political entities.
Well, what's actually happened, and I'll come to this a little bit later, is that there has, despite the failure of international policy. Or I should say, because of the very modest success of international policy, there has grown up a market for carbon credits, for carbon emission reductions. And the current price is somewhere around $25 a ton of CO2. And there are companies that are trading these. And one of the companies that was really pushing hard to have this happen was Enron. They were really good at this trading game, so they liked the idea of CO2 trading. And they were one of the few contributors to the Bush campaign who was really pushing hard for participation in Kyoto. They were really, really incensed when he pulled out. But they're off the scene now. Okay, let's move on and talk about carbon sequestration. What's the potential for carbon sequestration? Well, one simple way to do this calculation is to say, let's suppose we allow forests to regrow on all the areas where we cut them down for agriculture or timber. And so we can sort of do this calculation, and it turns out that we could absorb 100 gigatons of carbon by 2050, but that's equivalent to only about 10 to 20% of fossil fuel use over the same period. So this is sort of a sobering reality check that the trees aren't going to just magically save us. We cannot, even in this extreme example of essentially returning all native forest land to forest, we can't fix the problem with carbon sequestration. It could help, but it ain't going to do the whole job. All right, I want to, having sort of laid the framework for what types of things can be done, I want to report on some really good news about states and cities and then businesses that are doing something very positive along these lines. First of all, Wisconsin did a cost study a few years ago in which they calculated that if they took all of the major cuts in greenhouse gas emissions that cost no money, no net cost to the economy, they could achieve pretty deep reductions while having a net positive impact on the economy. So these are just those actions that individually make economic sense, primarily investing in energy efficiency in buildings and industry, as we saw before. But there are some other things too about government purchasing and waste processing and so on. New Jersey, this is when Bush's EPA administrator was governor of New Jersey, Christine Todd Whitman. Under her leadership, I understand she was sort of pushed into it, but they made a commitment to do something sort of like the Kyoto Protocol, and that is to bring their emissions 3.5% below 1990 levels by 2005. And this was, I think, in 1999. This was a pretty ambitious goal. I don't think they're going to make it, but at least they're trying. And they're doing this largely through voluntary efforts by industry, but with a lot of prodding and cooperation from government. The state of Oregon passed a law in 1997 that new power plants have to mitigate part of their carbon dioxide emissions. And the money goes to an entity called the Oregon Climate Trust, which then shops for ways to spend that money to reduce CO2, for example, by investing in new renewable energy or sequestration. More recently, the New England governors and the premiers of the Eastern Canadian provinces came out with a regional greenhouse gas reduction plan that they all agreed to. It's sort of along the lines of New Jersey, only they were agreeing on certain actions. And it's a lot easier to agree on actions than to shoot for a target and try to monitor whether your emissions, especially if you have the sequestration part of it, are in there. Just in the last month or so, 11 states, mostly again in the Northeast, but also I think including Arizona, threatened to sue the Bush administration if they did not do something positive about climate change. And it'll be interesting to see where that goes. I know that there are environmental attorneys who are seriously talking about suing oil and coal companies the way the tobacco companies were sued to get them to change. And when you start seeing multi-billion dollar litigation, it's really going to agitate those companies to behave more responsibly. And then cities, there are hundreds of cities around the country that have joined the Cities for Climate Protection campaign, where they agree to do a set of actions to monitor their greenhouse gas emissions, to report them, and then often through economically positive things. Portland, Oregon has reduced per capita greenhouse gas emissions about 5% in the last 10 years. It would have been a lot more if they had not at the same time closed down a nuclear power plant that was responsible for much of their energy. They then had to turn to other sources which were more expensive. Seattle and Miami are also, Miami of course is in there because they're really worried about sea level rise. I saw a TV program about climate change, this was probably 5 years ago. And the narrator, who was this cheerful British guy, was pretending that he was doing this in, I think, 2050. And he said, you know, you remember the internal combustion engine, coal, a place called Miami? South Florida is really worried about sea level rise. Businesses, and this, I think, is where the most hopeful message is, because throughout the 1990s, the Global Climate Coalition, which was funded by coal and oil, pretended to represent the business community. And in fact, there is not a business community. Some businesses are definitely going down the road of showing that you can reduce greenhouse gas emissions cost effectively. And the best example is British Petroleum, or as they like to be known, Beyond Petroleum. In 1997, Sir John Brown, the CEO of BP, said, as they left the Global Climate Coalition, "We know that the science is sound on global climate change, and we want to be part of the new energy future." Then in 1998, he made a goal of reducing their carbon dioxide, their greenhouse gases, measured as CO2 equivalent, by 10% below 1990 levels by 2010. So they're exceeding the Kyoto goal. That was their target. And what they did was they implemented an internal trading system where each of the 150 or so business units has a target that they have to meet. If they exceed that target, then they can trade their avoided emissions to other businesses, business units. And the business unit might be an oil refinery or a processing plant, or you know, they've got a lot of different things. And the price initially was very high, but as these business units figured out how to do this, the price dropped to about $25 a ton, which I've quoted to you before. They now think they're going to meet this goal next year. And this is a company. They're responsible to their shareholders for making a profit, and they are making a profit while at the same time reducing their greenhouse gas emissions. Now, of course, the product that they mainly sell generates a lot of greenhouse gas emissions. Operations are getting much more efficient. DuPont made a similar pledge They wanted to go 6 to 5% below 1990 levels by 2010. But if you look at the numbers, they were already halfway there when they made that pledge. So it was really just a sort of, let's continue this great path we're on. For them, much of their emissions are in really exotic, rare greenhouse gases, perfluorocarbons and things with really bizarre chemical formulas. So that, you know, they could do things that other industries couldn't. Stonyfield Farm Yogurt became the first company to be climate neutral, meaning that they pay extra money at the rate of $25 a ton or so to mitigate their own greenhouse gas emissions. And there are a lot of other companies since then that are climate neutral, and there's a whole climate neutral network. And you can, if they are climate neutral, their product will bear this stamp that says they are. All right, so it's time to talk about what we can do. It's great to hear that states and cities and businesses are making progress, and there are things we can do too. There are two main categories. The first is to reduce fossil fuel use, and the second is to speak up. So let's go through these. You can drive a more fuel-efficient car. You can spend a lot of money and get one of these hybrid vehicles. It's actually only $20,000, which is a lot if you're used to buying used cars, but maybe, I don't know, maybe you buy a Mercedes or something. You could get one of these 50-mile-a-gallon cars. You can also drive and fly less. I was shocked to find when I did a calculation of our family's greenhouse gas emissions that 70% of our emissions were from my work travel, which is a lot of flying. So I started skipping conferences, thinking, you know, what's the point in going to a conference and talking about climate change if I'm changing the climate together?
But that plane is still going there.
What?
That plane is still going where you
Well, that's go. True. But there is a sort of collective, you know, it's like voting. Well, what does my vote count? It does count. You know, maybe my ticket was that one last marginal ticket without which they would cancel the flight. Who knows?
America does that regularly, often a 4-hour later flight.
Yeah. You can also carpool and use public transportation or bicycle. It turns out that the first mile you drive in a car when the engine is cold emits, as now we're not talking about carbon dioxide, we're just talking about regular air pollution, as much air pollution as the next 7 miles. So those really short trips are the kind of the worst for air pollution. And if you can stand to walk half a mile to the store or something, then that's great. I once worked at a Christian school, and one of the teachers who lived on campus would drive to her office, which was 50 yards away. And I just couldn't believe this, but yeah, every day she cried back and forth. She didn't have any physical ailments that prevented her from walking 50 yards.
Amtrak. Trains, like Amtrak type trains, they use coal, right?
No, they use diesel.
Diesel.
The Union of Concerned Scientists produced a marvelous book, which if you really want to know the details about how you can help the environment, this is a good thing. They looked at all of American consumer activity, not business activity, just consumer activity, and weighted each activity by its damage to the environment in four categories: global warming, air pollution, water pollution, and land use. And then they went through category by category and talked about, you know, the biggies. And the biggest one is transportation. They ranked in there, if you have to travel, say, from Seattle to San Francisco by car, bus, train, or plane, per person, what is the most efficient way to go? And intercity bus is the most efficient, followed by train, followed fairly distantly by flying and driving, which are about the same per person. And if you're going with four people, it makes more sense to drive. But if you're going, and I think they said, you know, the average vehicle has 1.5 occupants or something like that. So if you're driving a very fuel efficient vehicle or you've got a lot of people, it makes more sense to drive. The thing is, and this is why flying is an issue, you know, most people aren't going to drive from Seattle to Miami and back in a week. It's virtually impossible. Flying allows us to travel much greater distances. So The train is a better alternative than planes.
But it won't be here anymore here in a few weeks.
That remains to be seen. There are certainly in the Northeast Corridor and around the big cities on the West Coast, it's got a future. I'm not sure about the Empire Builder from Chicago to Seattle through places like North Dakota and Montana. Okay, Energy Star appliances.
What's the name of that book?
It's called A Consumer's Guide to Effective Environmental Choices, and my last slide has the website where you can get it.
We don't have one.
Okay. Well, you can write to Union of Concerned Scientists. I'll give you the address. Okay. Energy Star appliances. I already mentioned that. Compact fluorescent lights will pay for themselves. Somebody estimated that if you thought about putting money in a bank or putting money into compact fluorescent bulbs, the annual rate of return on compact fluorescents is something like 25%. You can't get that anywhere else. If you want to really make a good return on your investment, you can buy compact fluorescent bulbs for your neighbor. You can charge money.
You get the same. Those fluorescents have to be on a while. I remember.
They work best in where they're not being cycled on and off rapidly. But the ballasts are more robust in those than they are for the big long tubes. It's more an issue of efficiency than duration, although that is an issue too. But if you're and they also don't work on dimmer switches.
So the new ones do.
Okay, thank you. I'm glad to learn that. In a lot of places, you can pay extra money to buy green power on your electric bill, and a lot of utilities are required to offer this and don't exactly advertise it. So you might just inquire. Also, as Rich Arneson said in our panel on Wednesday night, he used to work in this business. He said, make sure that what they're selling you is actually new renewables and not what they already had in their portfolio and are just repackaging at a higher price. Also, anything you buy comes to you by truck or train or some combination. So buying less stuff, there's a fossil fuel component of everything you buy. And recycling is a good thing to do, but especially aluminum, because it's so energy intensive to extract the aluminum from bauxite. So recycling aluminum saves a lot of energy. And finally, if you want to go beyond buying green power, you can actually offset your carbon dioxide emissions entirely at relatively low cost. I was surprised. I think for our family, I worked out if I exempted our my business travel, the rest of it would only cost maybe $100 a year to offset all our carbon dioxide emissions. But then we live in Seattle and we get all our electricity from hydro, so that knocks out a good chunk of it.
But what does that mean? How does it you offset it?
Excuse me?
I don't understand what that means. Does that mean that the green tech that you're buying?
What you're doing is essentially one of two things. You're either supporting new renewable energy, or you are paying for some kind of sequestration project, reforestation or afforestation or something along those lines. And the Bonneville Environmental Foundation here is one that offers green tags for sale, and you can go there and calculate your CO2 emissions. There's also a travel agency in Portland that will automatically offset the greenhouse gas cost on your airplane ticket. And they charge you just a little bit extra. I think it's $11 per ticket. They figure, let's not worry about number of miles per ticket. Let's just do a sort of average cost per ticket. So it's $11 per plane ticket. And I'm afraid I can't remember the name of that.
But essentially, you're making a donation to a nonprofit organization.
Yeah, to support the construction and sale of new renewable energy. So these, fairly low cost thing, you can feel good about your carbon dioxide emissions because you're offsetting them entirely. Yes?
Something, I don't know statistics or whatever, but something that I have heard is that our emissions from lawnmowers are even worse than our car emissions.
Thank you for bringing that up. Those inefficient motors that appear in lawnmowers and snowmobiles and jet skis and also some other power boats, are these two-stroke engines are really inefficient, and yeah, they have terrible air pollution. They also emit a lot more CO2 per unit of energy that you get out of them than a more efficient car engine. So some of these recreational uses are, and the UCS book goes into this, they say it doesn't represent a large fraction of total consumer activity, but if you're one of those people who is using an old inefficient lawnmower or you know, worse yet, your recreational form is just go out in the wilderness and spew noxious gases, that's a change that you can make that will really make a big difference.
Well, the use of the true stroke is gradually declining, and you know, you don't see too many lawnmowers with two-stroke engines by any means. Most of them are four-stroke, you know, typical four-cycle.
Okay. Engine,
so, I mean, it's been 15 or 20 years since I've seen a two-stroke lawnmower, so I'm concerned about that.
But is a four-cycle any? Well, they're obviously better, but they much better.
Yeah, I don't. They still don't have the same kind of efficiency that it.
Yeah. I mean, the four-cycle engine can use unleaded fuel and it contains its oil, so you don't have to worry about, you know, using a combination of oil and gasoline to lubricate the top end of the engines.
Things like chainsaws are still two-cycle mowers. We just bought brand new chainsaws here.
And I can speak for electric lawnmowers. I don't have a big lawn, but I just bought one with a cord. You get the cordless, they weigh a ton. And, works fine. Mm-hmm. It really does. The cord is not an issue.
My dear wife loves to get exercise by pushing a push mower over our quarter acre lawn. So. Finally, speak up. You know, these businesses that are going the route of green energy need our business. I mean, they need to know that we as customers like that idea. Also for investment, if you're investing money in the stock market anymore, think about green energy, because that's definitely a growth business because of these growing concerns and because it's becoming economically competitive. Promote the use of alternate forms of energy, solar and wind power. And finally, write to your elected officials. Even if they are already fully on board with this, they're always being attacked by lobbyists for the coal industry, even at the state level. So let them know that, you know, if you see in the paper that they've gone out and done something great, write to them and say, I think that's great. Or even if you don't know how they stand, just write to them. You know, they, especially in Congress, they prefer email. Send them an email and say, I care about climate change, please do something about it. And then they'll probably write back to you and say what they're doing or why they think they shouldn't have to. But they really do, you know, they hear from lobbyists. They also need to hear from concerned individuals. And that's why you can actually make a big difference to your elected official. And I think that's it. Union of Concerned Scientists provided some of the information for this. Here's their website. And if you want their address, I'd be happy to give that to you. It's 2 Gravel Square, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thank you.
Thank you.